Last week we were discussing some very... I'm sorry, sir. Yeah, last week we were discussing some very, very famous psukim that we say when we put back the Sefer Torah. Juracha darchei noam, the Torah is a way of pleasantness, v'chol nesifoseh shalom. All of its byways are conducive to peace. And Eitz Chaim hi l'machazikim bo, is a tree of life to those who support it. V'samcheo meyushar. And those who uphold it will be happy. And as I mentioned, the Vilna Gaon explains, there are two different ways that we support Torah. One is by financial assistance. And the other, which is even more important, is by emotional support, by making people feel, whether it's our family or others, that what they are doing is an important endeavor. It is worthwhile. It is not simply, I throw you some money, and that's it. It's interesting that, you know, these parshios in the Torah, we are reading about building a Mishkan. And there are certain lessons in building the Mishkan that are apropos to the way one supports Torah. First, let me tell you a story about the Panovitcher Rav. The Panovitcher Rav, Rav Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman, was Nifter quite a long time already. He was Nifter in the late 1960s. In fact, I still remember, I was... without giving away my age, although you can figure it out, I was a ninth grader in Neri Yisrael when the Panovitcher Rav was Nifter. But I'm not telling you, I was a very young ninth grader. and really, I had heard about the Panovitcher Rav, but I really didn't know who he was. But this was the first and last time I ever experienced this, where the Rosh Yeshiva gathered the whole yeshiva for a hesped. And he told everybody to sit on the ground. I had literally never seen this before, and I don't see it even now. But we all, like, sat on the ground as a sign of avelus for the Panovitcher Rav. The Panovitcher Rav was a phenomenal gadol b'Torah, but he himself said that he sacrificed much of his learning, much of his chidushim, much of his interpretations, because he was obsessed, literally obsessed, with rebuilding Torah in the world after the Holocaust. He was the Rav of Panovitch in Lithuania, and there were 800 communal Rabbanim in Lithuania. He was the only one who survived. The only Rav of Lita that actually survived. And he rebuilt. He built Panovitch, but he built many, many, many yeshivas. He built orphanages. He took care of Yesomim. He raised hundreds and hundreds of children after the Shoah. And he spent much of his time traveling, collecting money. In fact, the Satmar Rav once said when this was shortly after the Panovitcher Rav was Nifter, I think this is after the first moon launching, when they sent a man to the moon. So the Panovitcher Rav said, people started debating, is there life on other planets? Life on the moon. So he says, I don't care about science, I know for sure there is no life on other planets because the Panovitcher Rav wasn't there collecting money. If there would be anything there, he would have been there no matter what. And again, he was just a very, very amazing, amazing person. Again, interestingly, he was both Zionist and non-Zionist in his tekufa. The Israeli flag would fly on Yom HaTzmaut during his stewardship of the Panovitch Yeshiva. They didn't say Hallel, but they didn't say Tachanun, and you know, one of his famous witticisms was, Tim, if you're a Zionist, why don't you say Hallel? He says, what do you mean? He has the Minhag of Ben-Gurion on Yom HaTzmaut. Doesn't say Hallel, doesn't say Tachanun. Okay. Many, many stories. Someone once gave him, an anti-religious person once gave him a lot of money to build a school on the condition that the students don't wear kippot. So he built a Beis Yaakov, you know, different things. Okay, now that's a type of trick you can only do once. Next time they'll know. Okay, but the story I want to tell you is this. That the Panovitcher Rav once came to Chicago to collect money. And when he would collect money, it would be a whole experience. He would give a drasha full of brilliance and stories and humor and Torah and insights. A whole beautiful, beautiful, beautiful combination of all of the greatness and sweetness of Torah. And people would respond generously because he was an Adam Gadol and his presentation was a fantastic presentation. So he showed up at the same time that a mashulach from the much smaller, still in the Vardika yeshiva, actually the Vardik was the yeshiva in Bnei Brak earlier, even before Panovich. It was the first yeshiva in Bnei Brak, but it was, and it is, much, much smaller. And the mashulach sees the Panovich Rav show up at the same time he comes for money. He turns white, because he figures, oy vey smir, I cannot compete whatsoever. But then a second later, he figured, you know, I'm not even going to bother to compete. Who's going to give me anything? I'm just going to sit and enjoy the beautiful, sweet Torah of this Gadol. So the Panovicharev gave his speech with Torah, and again, with many stories and with humor, everything. And people are pulling out their checkbooks, and they're going to respond relatively generously. Chicago, anyway, is a very generous town in that way. But at the end of the Panovicharev speech, he said, Rabosai, there's a very, very chashuv yid from a beautiful yeshiva in Bnei Brak, and I know the yeshiva well. I tell you what, all the money you would give to me, give to him instead. Because this is a worthy, worthy cause. Perhaps he doesn't want to talk to you today, but give it to him. So suffice it to say that the mashulach did much better than he ever did on any of his other trips. Really phenomenal. And he went to the Panovicharev afterwards, and he said, I'm really so grateful for what you did, but how could the Rebbe do it? You traveled all the way from Eretz Yisrael to Chicago, and in those days, the jets, you know, they didn't have jets, it was a longer flight anyway, and, you know, you're going to other places, and you gave up all of this money for your yeshiva? So the Panovicharev said, and this is very unusual, it's not a common attitude even among Gedolim today, he says, I don't know what you mean, my yeshiva, your yeshiva. He says, we are all on the same team. If the money I could raise today, let's say, would support 20 people learning for a month, he says, I don't care if they're under the Panovich roof or under the Novartic roof. L'mai nafkamina. The money is to enable 20 people, or whatever the number is, to learn Torah. And he said, it makes no difference. That is what L'shem Shemayim is. Now this is indeed a very, very uncommon attitude. Because everyone has a proprietorship sense of their yeshiva, their makom, and the like. But the sign of an Adam Gadol is that he's serving Hashem. And the only question is, what gives HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kavyachol the greatest return on the investment? And it makes no difference here, there, wherever it would be. Now the truth of the matter is, there is a later person who very much was that way, and that's Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, that's how the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, who, like the Panovicharev, was a phenomenal builder of Torah, with the additional handicap of the debilitating illness that he had for many years. But the truth of the matter is, whenever he would go collect money, he would have, you know, two burly guys from the Mir office with him, because he would give the money away. He'd go to Lakewood, and he would see Avrechen. He said, you need the money to learn, and there Israel, you need the money to learn. So they'd have to have people who would kind of, as soon as the money came in, they would take it away from him. And the end is, this was also what he learned from his uncle, the predecessor of Leisha Yehuda Finkel, the Alter of Slobodka's son, who was very upset whenever somebody said to him in the administration that a certain decision might hurt the Mir Yeshiva. He said he doesn't care about that at all. The question is it going to advance Torah overall? Or is it not going to advance Torah overall? And that's important. But whether it hurts his particular institution, he said, is not of concern to him. And he was actually upset when anybody made a cheshbon that something might upset or might hurt a particular institution. This is what it means to be machzik Torah. You're not machzik your yeshiva, your makom, your position. Your job in life, our job in life, is to create as much mitzvos, as much Torah learning as is possible. Again, this is rare. That's why I'm telling you stories about the Panovicharev and Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel. I mean, this is not a common attitude. That's why we have to show gedolim that exemplify it. But it is the attitude to which we should aspire in our Avodah Hashem. The Chazon Ish, although this is a little off topic, but the Chazon Ish makes the same point about Chesed. Now we're talking about Hafsakas Torah, but the same point is about Chesed. He says, the Chazon Ish makes the point that very often we do Chesed because there's a certain ego satisfaction in the fact that I can be a benefactor to somebody. It makes me feel good. It makes me feel chashuv. In other words, when I give, you know, either people see it and I get covered, or even if nobody sees it, but there's kind of a sense that I build up myself. So the chesed is said, now of course, it's better to do chesed with that motive than not to do it at all, no question. No question. But it is tainted a little bit, because it's not totally l'shem shemayim. And the chesed ish gave, in the Sefer Emunah Bitachon, he gives a little bit of a thought experiment to test. Now this is a, you know, again, it's a high standard, to test what our kavanah is. Let's imagine that you're a person who loves to have orchim for Shabbos, right? And you always look. You don't just wait if someone calls you up, but you look for opportunities. You see somebody who doesn't have a place, and you, like Avraham Avinu, you want to bring them in, you want to take care of them. That's a wonderful, wonderful thing. So imagine this. It's Friday night. Now, he was using an example of a man, but a woman could be the same thing on the woman's side. It's Friday night, and you don't have your orchim, and you're very distraught. You have no one to share your home with. You have no one to show hospitality. And you're looking around for someone that I could invite to my home. And then I see a person who seems to be unattached and unconnected, and people don't know him. And I'm so excited that Baruch Hashem, I'm able to give him a home and a place. And I go over to him and I say, Reb Yid, it's so wonderful to see you. It would be my great honor to have you in my home and share hospitality. And the person says, oh, thank you so much. But 2 minutes ago, somebody just invited me. So the Chazanish says, stop the clock. Are you happy or are you unhappy? So he says the following. If the concern was truly, I want to help this person, I want this person to be comfortable, I want this person to be taken care of, the Chazanish says, you don't really care if it's you or somebody else. Assuming that the other place is a suitable, good place. But if it's a matter of ego, then you're going to be a little upset because you don't get that chance, you know. So the Chesedish says that although Chesed, even for the latter motive, is certainly a wonderful thing, God forbid, and it's human and it's normal and it's natural. But the Chesedish just points out that sometimes we do mitzvot because they serve us in different ways, and we're not truly serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And by Hafzakas Torah, that's the same thing. When a person has a proprietary interest. In fact, I can say, I mentioned Rav Sri Finkel, and his uncle, his great-uncle rather, was Rav Lazer Yehuda Finkel, the first mirror Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. And of course, Rav Lazer Yehuda Finkel's father was the Alter of Slobodka. And one thing that we say about the Alter of Slobodka is the Alter of Slobodka constantly sent away his best students to start new yeshivos in different places. Even though, in a sense, he's weakening his own institution by sending away these great... These were not branches of the Slobodka. These were independent yeshivos. And he would send away the absolute best people to kind of start this new yeshiva in a good way. Because once again, he said he had no sense that his institution was more important than any other institution. Again, it's a very, very rare madrega, but that's what we mean by Hachzakas Torah. Let me mention one other point based on a story. And that is, you know, I've mentioned before before we actually started looking at the Pesukim, we were talking about the Musar movement and the different personalities in the Musar movement. So I had mentioned the very, very interesting, somewhat extreme person, the Alter of Nevardik, Rav Yosef Yoizel Horvitz, who actually was, interestingly enough, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz's grandfather. It was his mother's father, Rav Rafael Shmulevitz. Rav Chaim's father was the son-in-law of the Alter of Nevardik. The Alter of Nevardik was also the Rebbe of the Stipler, right? The Stipler is actually a Nevardiker, was a Nevardiker, and the like. So I mentioned the Alter of Nevardik was somewhat of an extreme person. He was a hermit for 2 years. He locked himself in a house. And then he started, you know, he was a hermit for 2 years, and then he started 110 yeshivas. He was able to, he went from one extreme to the other extreme. And he had extreme shitas in emunah. In fact, the Chazanish argued with him. The Alter of Nevardik said, if your emunah is strong enough, then Hashem will do miracles for you, and you don't have to make rational calculations. Again, different shitas about this. So the story goes that the Alter of Nevardik also had to collect money because he had over 100 yeshivas. In fact, in Stalinist Russia, Nevardik and Chabad were the only religious institutions that managed to stay vibrant even in the middle of the Stalinist persecutions. So the story goes that he went to a notorious miser, a rich Jew who didn't like to give tzedakah. And he got a lot of money. So different Rosh Hashivas heard about this, and see, Rosh Hashiva has to collect money. That's the problem, right? If you want your child to be a person who has all the time to learn, he should not become a Rosh Hashiva. Better to be a stockbroker or something else. He'll have much more time to learn. A Rosh Hashiva spends so much time collecting money. So the other Rosh Hashivas asked the Altar of Nevardik, how did you get money out of this person? So the Altar of Nevardik said the following, I'll tell you the difference between you and me. You come to a rich man's house, and you see the carpets, and you see the beautiful furniture, and you wipe your feet, and you don't, you know, you be sure to put your coat in the designated closet, and, you know, you don't put your fingerprints, you know, on the tables, etc. So you convey to the person in every gesture, wow, you have such beautiful things, you have so much money. And you build up what the person has, and then you ask him to give it up? After you've told him this is the most precious, beautiful thing, people don't want to give up things that they consider treasures and beautiful and significant and important. The Altar of Nevardik says, when I show up to the guy's house, I don't wipe my shoes, I track mud, I'm not sure if this is actually true, I track mud in the carpet, you know, I put my dirty boots on top of his fancy table. I communicate to him, you have nothing. Money, gashmius, materialism is absolutely worthless in and of itself, but I have a deal for you. I will give you a way that all of this material wealth can become really, really wonderful in terms of Olam Haba. So therefore, he says, when you come in, the altar said, you're asking the person to give. People don't like to give. When I come in, I'm asking him to take. I'm giving him something for his money. I'm conveying the idea that when you give, you're actually taking. By the way, this is Merumas in the Parsha. That's why the Parsha says, Vayikhu li truma, they shall take for me a donation that a Jew has to feel that when he gives tzedakah, hachzakas Torah, building the Beis HaMikdash, they are not giving up something. They are taking something. There was a maisa with Rav Shacht. A boy was engaged to a young lady, and he took the kala to meet Rav Shach. And again, I can't vouch if these stories are true. I think they reflect a perspective. This is chas v'shalom not halacha l'maisa, so please don't apply this in any practical way. But it does show you a certain perspective. What the woman said was to Rav Shach, he says, I want my husband to learn so much. I will make every sacrifice. I will give up everything. I will be willing to live, you know, in starvation. I will give up everything so my husband will learn. So it sounds good. So after she left the room, Rav Shach says, break off the shidduch immediately. What's the pshat? Because if a person basically looks at a life of Torah learning as sacrifice, deprivation, martyrdom, we can do that for a while. But after a while, we come to resent it. After a while, we become to hate it. It's the other way around. The idea, again, this is not halacha l'maisa, this is a perspective. The attitude should be that I'm not giving up. What I'm getting is so much more than I'm getting, than I'm giving up. And that is the attitude that can sustain a person and give the person the energy to keep on going. We cannot be a martyr. In fact, I just heard a mice about Dostoevsky. I have no idea if it's true, and it sounds a little odd. But Dostoevsky, who was kind of a religious fanatic in his way, decided that he thought that when you marry somebody that you care about, that is, it's kind of perverse, that is selfish because you're marrying somebody because they make you happy. So he determined to marry a woman that he didn't care about at all, and he would, you know, give her tzedakah and chesed and the like. And basically he said he was committing himself to a life of eternal martyrdom in the marriage because he thought that would be the more righteous spiritual thing to do. Now the end of the story is that this woman committed suicide at some point. You know. So once again, martyrdom is not really a modality. In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein used to say, the old Yiddish saying, it's hard to be a Jew. famous Yiddish saying. He says was something that really caused a whole generation of Jews in America to leave Yiddishkeit, because if they keep on hearing from their parents and their grandparents how hard it is, and indeed in the 1920s and earlier it was very hard. You didn't have any job protection. If you didn't go to work on Saturday, then virtually every Monday you needed to find a new job. Even the early Shabbos minyanim in America came from people who had to go to work on Shabbos and the like, and we can't judge them because it was very, very, very difficult. There were some heroic yechidim, very few, who remained Shomer Shabbos even in that tekufa, when there were very few yeshivos and no legal protections at all. Yeah, Baruch Hashem. It's a tremendous.
Yes,
that's a tremendous Mesiras Nefesh. And those are the greatest tzaddikim. We forget now that Baruch Hashem, it is relatively easy to be a Shomer Shabbos. We forget about the sacrifices. But there were many who couldn't do that, and they conveyed the attitude that Yiddishkeit is so hard. So when you have a new generation growing up in a free society where they could be anything they want. They could go to college, they could be lawyers, they could be doctors, they could change their names, they could move out to the suburbs. So why should they want to continue to be in something that's hard and oppressive and bitter? So Rav Moshe Feinstein said, again, he himself was, he was a little after that generation, but he certainly knew many men in Lower East Side, he certainly knew many, many parents who had lost their children in the waves of assimilation. He said that the attitude we have to convey, and of course we have to feel it in order to convey it, is the Yiddishkeit is joyous and simcha. And whatever we give up, we get more in return. And that's what the Elder of Slobodka, Elder of Nebardik said, that you're not being asked to give up, you're being asked to get and to take and the like. Right? So that goes back to the attitude of Hachzakas Torah.
What's the relationship between the Elder of Nebardik and the current Nebardik Yeshiva from Rav Yaffin? Is there a family?
Yeah. Rav Avram Yaffin was the son-in-law of the Alter of Nevardik. Was a son-in-law of the Alter of Nevardik. Rafael Shmulevitz was one.
No, I didn't know the time, because I'll tell you a few stories.
Yeah.
So the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yaffin, his wife was my teacher for preparation for marriage
right.
in 12th grade.
Right.
And she was talking to us about marrying a learning boy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
4 years, Dr. Yaffin, she's Yaffin, remember her?
Yeah.
So, 4 years later, I get engaged to my husband. But before that, he brings me to his Rosh Hashiva's house to introduce me. And my husband was learning with Rav Yaffin, the smicha.
Right.
So, she Yaffin opens the door.
Yeah.
He goes to church. I remember what you said in 12th grade, you didn't want to marry a learning boy. Have you thought about this?
Oh, wow. Well. Baruch Hashem. Rav Yom Yaffin, who's, was the son-in-law of the Alter of Nevardik, yeah. Rav Yom Yaffin was already Nifter, also 1970 or the about, and the like. Yeah. So Rav Yom Yaffin was Rav Chaim Shmulevitz's uncle, also. That's the relationship. So everyone is related, one way or the other. That's why Rav Chaim Shmulevitz is very interesting, because he incorporated Mir, Slobodka, and Nevardik in one person. Like, he combined all of the different trends and the like. Okay, because he was married to Rav Leizer Yehuda's daughter. Okay, whatever. Alrighty, so that's something to think about. Now, there is one more pasuk that we recite that I also want to mention. In fact, again, we recite the pasukim not in the order they are in Mishnah, and why that's so, I'm not entirely sure. But the fourth pasuk in this grouping is the beginning of Perek Dalet. So skip ahead a little bit. And this is Pasuk Beis. Perek Dalet, Pasuk Beis. Again, these are verses that we recite when we put back the Torah. Shabbos, Monday, Thursday. Ki lekach tov nasati lochem. Torasi al ta'azovu. Ki lekach tov. I have given you a good taking. Again, this ties into what we just said. You're taking something. I've given you a good taking. Do not abandon my Torah. This is Perek Dalet, Pasuk Beis. Okay? This is actually the first of the verses from Mishlei that we recite, but it's the latest in the book. Whether it's Drachah, Darchei Noam, etc., we recite that afterwards. Now, Lekach literally means taking, but the Gemara in Brachos has an interesting drasha on the word Lekach, and it says, Lekach is as if it is Mekach, it is a purchase, something that you buy. I have given you a good deal on the purchase. And therefore it describes HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a mocher, a seller, and we are a lokeach, a buyer, and God as seller is telling you, I gave you a good deal on the purchase. Now what does that mean? So the Gemara in Brachos says that the Midah of Hashem is not like the Midah of a Basar Vidam, a human being. When a human being has to sell a very precious heirloom or legacy, it is the derech of the mocher to be unhappy. Even if I needed the money, but if I had to sell a very precious painting or a jewel that had been in my family, the mocher is unhappy. The buyer is happy. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not that way. Even though he sold the Torah, he is still rejoicing with us. This is a Gemara in Brachos. This is not even the Vilna Gaon. Now, the obvious question is, the analogy doesn't seem to fit at all. When I sell an heirloom, I don't have it anymore, so I'm unhappy. Here, Hashem gave us the Torah, but in the sense that he commanded us to keep the Torah. But what did he lose? He didn't lose it. He gave us the Torah, so we will do his will. Why are we comparing Hashem to a mocher, this is Gemara in Brachos, to a mocher, a seller, that had a precious heirloom that he gave up, right? What is the concept of giving it up? So here we have a beautiful explanation from someone who was really the Gadol Hador, although perhaps he's a little less known today. This was Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Of course, YU is named after him, Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, and the like. But Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was the Gadol Hador at the end of the 19th century. He was Nifter at the very end of the 19th century. And when I say Gadol Hador, you have to know what I mean. I don't just mean, you know, greatest Talmud Chacham, but someone who really took responsibility for every part of Klal Yisrael. In terms of, and this was during Tsarist persecutions and the like, and he really was the one who was responsible for everything that was happening in the Jewish world. Again, I forgive me for digressing. Whenever I mention a name, just like it says in Mishlei Taka, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, right? That's Zatzal. When you mention a righteous person, you should always give him a blessing. So I have to tell you one quickie about Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, then I'll tell you his pshat. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was a person of extraordinary kindness, extraordinary tov lev, but also great common sense and amazing perception, besides his greatness and Torah knowledge. So the story goes that he once gets a shaila from a community, and it seems to be, it was a little complicated, but it seems to be a relatively routine question about shechita and treifa and the mixing of kosher meat and non-kosher meat, and they want to know his answer. And he's wondering, why are they sending me this shaila? This is not a shaila that, you know, is so extraordinarily difficult it has to go to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. It could have been handled by local rabbis. So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan now remembered the scenario. Ah, I know what might have happened here. This community recently hired a young rav with no experience. There are people in the community who don't like him and want to get rid of him. So probably they ask him this question. He may have inadvertently given the wrong answer. And if I give the right answer, they're going to use it against him and remove him from his position. This is all his speculation. So what am I supposed to do? If I write them the wrong answer, which makes the rabbi look good, but I'm giving them the wrong halacha, I'm not allowed to do that. If I write them the right answer, this rabbi is going to lose his parnassah. I can't do that. So what do I do? So this is what he did. He wrote the wrong answer that he guessed that the rabbi gave. He sent it by mail. He then sent a telegram, which they would get first, saying, I originally wrote something, but that is incorrect. I made a mistake. Please ignore the letter that you're going to get in a week. The telegram is the psak halacha. Now, look at what he did over here. They're going to get the right psak before they get the wrong psak, so they're not going to apply the wrong psak. But they can't possibly use it against the young rabbi, because even the Gadol Hador made the mistake. So it must be such a complicated question that even the Gadol Hador didn't really know the answer. So he was willing to embarrass himself, to humiliate himself, to show that he didn't know something in order to spare that Rav the embarrassment of being discredited. Like, this is an example of the type of person he was, Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. He was very, very involved. He was known as the father of Agunot. Because, now, he didn't have so much the Agunas that we have today. The Agunas today tend to be the husbands who refuse to give a get. But the Agunos at that time, yeah, some of them too, were mainly people who disappeared. Either they disappeared in war, or sometimes they would run away. They were kind of deadbeats, but they would run away because of debts or because of fear of bankruptcy, and they would just disappear. And it would be very difficult to determine whether they died or not, and he literally would stay up day and night for months at a time finding heterim and ways for these women to be able to marry according to halacha. So he was called, when he died, all the hespedim talked about he was the father of the agunot, who are now orphaned with no one to stand up and help them and protect them. So he was an extraordinarily great, great, great person. In fact, they tell the story that even the great Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav of Brisk, who was really, perhaps we would call him the Gadol in deep analytical Gemara learning, but Rav Chaim didn't like the Paskin practical shailas. He would defer to Rav Yitzchak Yochanan. And the story goes, again, these are stories, I'm not sure if they're true, but the story goes that when he would ask Rav Yitzchak Yochanan a shaila, he would always say, just tell me yes or no, don't give me any reasons. Because your reasons are different than my reasons, I have a different methodology, I have a different way of thinking, I can sometimes think your thought process isn't correct, but I know that Hashem made you the posek for Klal Yisrael. So whatever your answer is right, even if the reasoning I don't accept. So he says, don't give me any reasons. Yes or no, I will accept whatever it is that you say. This is a bit of a mystical approach to Psak Halacha, where the posek that Hashem designated as the posek hador will be mechavein to the emes, even if it's through a route which in itself might be an erroneous route. In fact, the Nedeb Yehuda, much earlier in the 1700s, when he was appointed to be Rav of Prague. So there were people who didn't want him to be Rav. There were great Talmidei Chachamim in Prague who wanted the job. So they used to ask Nedeb Yehuda all sorts of complicated questions to try to trip him up. And they would ask him shailas, and of course Nedeb Yehuda was able to answer all of the different shailas. But one time he was stuck, and he said to the shayel, who said this was a real question, he says, you made up that question. That's not a real question. So he says, how do you know? He says, because when a real question is asked to me, I feel Hashem giving me help in answering it, because it's something that people have to know. There's a siyata dishmaya that Hashem gives the posek of the generation to be able to resolve. If you're just making up questions, I don't necessarily get the siyata dishmaya, because Hashem gives me the siyata dishmaya when I need it to give people practical guidance, and not necessarily for every theoretical question. This is what the Nedeb Yehuda actually said. Okay, all of that was a little digression, forgive me. But now we're back to the Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos says that God is the seller and we are the buyer, and God gave up the Torah, but he is still happy for us. Question, how did God give up the Torah? So Rav Yitzchak Yochanan brings a famous Gemara in Bava Metzia that I'm sure you've heard of. This is the argument between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua about the ritual impurity of a certain oven, whether a certain oven is Mekabel Tuma or not Mekabel Tuma. This is called Tanur Shel Achnai, the Tanur of Achnai. And Rabbi Eliezer said the Tanur is Tahor, it cannot become Tameh. And the Chachamim said the Tanur can become Tamei. And they took a vote, and the majority of the sages decided the Tanur is Tai. But Rabbi Eliezer refused to agree with the majority. He refused. He says, I'm right, you're wrong. And he tried to convince them, and he tried to argue, and none of his arguments worked. So after his arguments didn't work, he started calling on Hashem to do supernatural miracles to prove that he was right. And he said, if the halachas like me, let the carob tree uproot itself and fly away. And the tree, like a rocket, just popped out of the ground and flew away. The Chachamim said, we don't listen to trees. That doesn't impress us. Then he said, if the halachas like me, let the river reverse its course. Like, you know, the Chicago River, the Army Corps of Engineers actually reversed the flow of the river. And the river went in the opposite direction. And the Chachamim said, as you would expect, we don't listen to rivers. Well, if the halachas like me, let the walls of the Beis HaMidrash cave in. And the walls began caving in. And then Rabbi Yoshua stood up to the walls and said, don't you dare, you have to listen to the sages. So the walls didn't know what to do. They didn't know, should they bend or should they straighten up? And that's why the Gemara says, to this day, the walls of that Beis HaMidrash were slanted, like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Just kind of explaining why, you know, it had that architectural quirk. And again, it's getting repetitive already, the Chachamim said, we do not listen to walls. So finally, he got out the biggest gun you could possibly get. And he said, if the halachas like me, let there be a voice from heaven, a heavenly voice, a bas kol it's called, declaring that I'm right, Hashem. And of course Hashem did the miracles anyway. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to the Chachamim, Rabbi Eliezer's right. And the Chachamim said back to the bas kol, keep out of it. Mind your own business. You yourself said in the Torah, Lo bashamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven. You told us, you said it, Hashem, that the halacha is to be decided by human reasoning, again, based on the principles of the Torah, by the majority vote, I don't mean majority vote of any rabbi, but of the Sanhedrin, whatever it would be. And therefore, you yourself, HaKadosh Baruch, have to follow your Torah. And if in your Torah, halacha is resolved this way, then even if the Chachamim get it wrong in a mathematical sense, it becomes right. It becomes right. Because operationally, halacha is defined by the Chachamim and not by some abstract divine will. To put it another way, it is the divine will that halacha on earth go through a human process of reasoning and analogy and the like. Now, again, there's a lot of questions here. The Drusha Saran asked, oh yeah, and by the way, and if you think this sounds like a very nervy thing to do, one of the Amorayim who was recounting this story met Eliyahu HaNavi. And Eliyahu HaNavi, of course, lives forever, so he asked Eliyahu HaNavi, what did Hashem do when they said, Lo b'shamayimi? And it says, Hashem laughed, and Hashem said, Nitzchuni banai, my children have beat me, they're right, I'm staying out of this fight. Now, the Gemara goes on, by the way, the story is a very, very sad story. Rabbi Eliezer still refused to change his mind. This is Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkinus. And he was excommunicated. He was the greatest gadol. And he was excommunicated because he refused to accept the decision of the majority. And he was no longer allowed to teach Torah. And he was crying and sobbing. He said he is like a Sefer Torah that is wrapped up, totally tied down. And he said that all the Torah that he has will no longer be able to, be able to be taught, etc. But he didn't change his position. It's interesting that the person who put him in Cheirim was his brother-in-law, the one who married Rabbi Eliezer's sister, and that was Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel was the one who excommunicated his brother-in-law. And the Gemara has an interesting... the relation is the other way around. Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkinus married Rabban Gamliel's sister. You'll see why that's important. Rabbi Eliezer's wife was Rabbi Gamliel's sister. So the story goes in the Gemara that Rabbi Eliezer's wife never let her husband say Tachanun after Shmona Esrei. She would always interrupt him. Why? Because Tachanun is the time of prayer when you pour out your personal anguish and suffering. And she was afraid that if he would pour out his anguish to Hashem, Hashem would punish her brother. So she would never let him say Tachanun. So you might ask the question, well, maybe he could say Tachanun later, but the answer is Tachanun has to be right after Shmona Esrei. So if she interrupted him, he wouldn't have it. But one day she forgot it was Rosh Chodesh. I'm sorry, she thought it was Rosh Chodesh. So she didn't bother to watch him, because on Rosh Chodesh there's no Tachanun, but it was not Rosh Chodesh. And she saw him saying Tachanun. So she said to him, "You have killed my brother today." And that very moment they got news that Rabbi Gamliel had in fact died. Now again, I don't think we have to understand the story that Rabbi Eliezer prayed for the death of his brother-in-law. I don't think we have to look at it that way. But he simply prayed to Hashem about the anguish and suffering, and then Hashem automatically will avenge the honor. Now, Rabbi Gamliel is a very complicated personality because he used the excommunication fairly liberally on a number of great rabbis. And Rabbi Gamliel had a shita that the need to preserve unity in Klal Yisrael in the generations after the Chorban was so great that he could not allow these various dissenters to exist. So he had a very strong style. And in fact, earlier he had been deposed because of that, because of what he did to Rabbi Yoshua. That itself is a very, very fascinating story. But I want to focus on the main point of Lo B'Shamayimi. The Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, one of the Rishonim of the 13th century, raises a very, very important question. He says, what is the idea that the Torah is not in heaven? What sense does that make? When we debate halacha, we are ultimately trying to figure out what does Hashem want us to do in this case. What is the will of God? Now, if God tells you this is my will, we say that that's irrelevant as to what is God's will? Now, if you were to tell me we don't trust heavenly voices because maybe they're fake, maybe they're hallucinations, maybe they're not true, that's one thing. But that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara doesn't say that the heavenly voice was not authentic. The Gemara says, even if it is 100% authentic, we don't pay attention to it. The Ran says, that doesn't make sense. Let's take a simple example where kids want to buy their parents a gift for his or her birthday. So they're debating, what does mom or dad, what does Abba and Ima like? They're like this or like this. So a parent happens to overhear, and parent says, well, I really don't like this, I like this. So the kids say, stay out of it. We're deciding what it is that you like. What you say you like is not important. But that doesn't make sense. Isn't halacha the same thing? We're trying to figure out what the will of God is. So when God tells you his will, it's not nogea. And that's why, by the way, a Nabi cannot even tell you what the halacha is through prophecy. So the Drasha Saran says the following idea. And this is an idea that can be misunderstood and it can be misapplied, so it's a bit of a risky, subtle idea. And that is, he says, that when we say the Torah is truth, halacha is truth, it is not truth in the sense of a mathematical axiom. In mathematics, mathematical truth, there is only one, at least in Euclidean mathematics, I know there are actually mathematics which have indeterminate systems, without getting into that. But in standard arithmetic, let's say, there is only one possible right answer. 1 + 1 = 2. If you say it's 3, it's not that you have your opinion and I have my opinion. Rather, I'm right and you're wrong. In Torah, it's not that way. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Moshe Rabbeinu general principles of the oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh. But it was then left to the Chachamim in every generation. Now, who are the Chachamim is a big question. I'm glossing over it. Not everybody qualifies, of course. But the Chachamim in every generation grapple with those fundamental principles that Hashem gave Moshe B'Sinai, and try to apply them to new situations. So if you have a situation, and this happens even today, surrogate motherhood, genetic engineering. Did Hashem give Moshe a specific answer about that? No. But Hashem gave Moshe the principles out of which every generation will be able to figure out how Hashem's will apply. But it was Hashem's will that the truth of Torah be explicated, developed, and implemented. Not through Hashem giving us a specific answer to every question, but by giving us the principles out of which the Chachamim could figure that out. And that is why the Ran says, when you have a machlokas, one says kosher, one says treif, which is right and which is wrong, the Gemara says they're both right, because they're both based on the same principles. La halacha can only do one thing. Now, people ask the question, how can they both be right? What did Hashem tell Moshe? The answer is Hashem gave Moshe general principles out of which we apply it to different situations. But Loba Shemayimi therefore reflects the idea that it's God's will that final answers be determined by the Chachamim and not by God's own. God himself has a position on every question, but he didn't communicate the answer to every question. He communicated the principles. And therefore the yesod of Loba Shemayim it is God's will that the Torah be amplified and applied by the human endeavor of the Chachamim. So even if they get it wrong in an objective sense, it becomes right in the sense that Hashem wants us to keep the Torah in this world. Now this is a very complicated and subtle idea, because this doesn't mean every single person can come up with their own interpretation of the Torah. We're talking about the Chachamim. Who are the Chachamim? That's a very, very excellent question, but this is what the Chachamim do. Now, the question, and that is why Machlokes is not inconsistent with revelation. One of the big questions people have is, if God gave the written Torah and the oral Torah to Moshe and Har Sinai, how can there be arguments about things? Didn't Hashem give an answer? And if you're going to say, well, Hashem gave an answer, but we forgot it, or the transmission is not accurate, then God forbid, you're undermining the entire system. But according to the Ran, it's not a problem. The revelation at Sinai did not mean that God gave Moshe an answer to every conceivable question. He gave Moshe principles and klolim, the Yud Gimel Midos that the Torah and the Drashas ban, and then it's left to the Chachamim, which means Torah Shebal Peh is not simply transmitting information, but there's a dynamic, creative, interactive process where the Chachamim become, and Klal Yisrael, become the co-creators of Torah Hashem. Now, you might ask a question. That's a pretty messy way to give the Torah. That's a giving of the Torah that invites debate, ambiguity, lack of clarity. Why couldn't Hashem just give us direct answers to every question? Now you might say, well, Hashem couldn't give an answer to every question, they wouldn't understand it. Surrogate motherhood, genetic engineering, nuclear war. Well, Hashem could have given to Moshe envelopes to say, even stone envelopes like the Flintstones, you know, and say, don't open up before 5770. And I open up, surrogate motherhood, whatever, all the answers. Because Hashem could have given answers. Why does he create a Torah that is so open to ambiguity and machlokas and uncertainty? The answer is, this is Hashem's love for Am Yisrael, that he wants us to be his partners in his Torah. He didn't want it to be a silver platter. Think about, I use this now before, you've heard it before, about you want to make a cake. I often say this with men's group, but with women's group maybe it's even more appropriate. Let's say you want to make a cake for your 4-year-old, then gone. There are two ways you can do it. The best way is that when she is sleeping or in gone, you make a cake. So it'll take you 20 minutes, etc. Everything will be fine. But the deeper, more meaningful way of doing it is you make it with the child. You invite the child to be a part of the process. Now, when you make a cake with a 3 or 4 year old, you know, the kitchen is going to be a mess. There'll be sugar on the floor and chocolate on the counter, and there'll be an eggshell, you know, in the batter, and it'll be uneven, so it'll be overly burnt here, and it'll be underbaked there. So you could certainly have done a much better job by yourself. But the depth of love inheres in relationship and interactivity. I don't think I'm being irreverent if I say, let's say, that Talmudic structure is a very, very messy structure. It's filled with debate, with infinite possibilities, with confusion, with groping in the darkness for trying to figure out what the right answer is. Hashem could have given us a direct answer to Moshe Rabbeinu to every conceivable question. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I could have made the cake myself, but I want you to make the cake. Even though the cake will be messier, it'll be, you know, less clear in many cases. But the love is in the relationship. Now this is, I'm expanding on Ravitzik Ochanan. Ravitzik Ochanan says, in a very real way, God did sell us the Torah. God abdicated his control over the meaning of his text. God authored the Torah. God gave Moshe Rabbeinu the principles of the oral law, and then he left it to us to interpret. And he gave up control. Because if we say something, we mean the Chachamim say something, and Hashem says it's wrong, we say back to Hashem, stay out of it, it's ours. So now the analogy is very, very perfect. The Torah was not only commanded to us, it was actually given to us in the sense that the Mocher, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, no longer has exclusive control over the meaning and implementation of the Torah. That is mamash, the principle, lo bashamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven. And that is why the Gemara in Brachos says, ki lekach tov, Hashem is the mocher, we are the lokeach, Hashem has sold us the Torah. Now, this is an idea that on some level might sound a little abstract to us, because after all, we're not in the position of, you know, making new interpretations of what the halach is, you know, we're not the poskim of the door or the like. But in microcosm, what the Mekubalim call bezeir anpin, in a small way, this is an aspect that applies to each and every one of us. Because sometimes, you know, when a person learns the Torah, they are supposed to bring their creativity to it as well, as to what does the text say to you. Now, sometimes people feel, oh, if a commentary doesn't say it, you know, it's not legitimate. Like, sometimes someone might say a beautiful thought, and someone would say, which parish says that? Sometimes the answer is the parish of my heart and my mind. That is something that is legitimate. Now, of course, you have to know, obviously, if it contradicts Chazal, etc., you know, that would make it not proper. But within those aspects that are consistent, they are not contradictory, Hashem is inviting every one of us to bring our heart and our mind and our soul and our unique experiences to bear on how this Torah will apply to our particular lives. So in many ways, the notion that the Torah is an interactive experience between Hashem and the Jewish people. It's not simply HaKadosh Baruch Hu talking, so to speak. But it's my talking back out of my soul, which is also from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that creates the truth of Torah. And that is in the sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the Mocher, and we are the Lokeach, and that is the meaning of Lekach Tov Nasati Lachem, Torah si al tazovo. Now it is interesting, just to add one thing, that we say it when we put the Sefer Torah back. Now the Sefer Torah is the written Torah. Now it's interesting, based on this explanation, ki lekach tov is primarily referring to the oral Torah, the Torah Shebal Peh, where we have creative and dynamism and interactivity, etc., trying to resolve contradictions. But it could very well be that it makes a lot of sense that as we affirm the greatness of the written Torah, we also affirm simultaneously the greatness of the oral Torah, that we consider both of them the same. Otherwise, one is a Karaite, right? And a Karaite does not believe. They're still around, Karaites, a small group. They have a website, they have everything, but they're the ones who don't believe in the Torah Shebaal Peh at all. In the time of the Bayis Sheni, there was a movement called Tzedukim. Now, Karaites and Tzedukim were not the same movement, but philosophically, they shared the same hashkafa. And this is why Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us to bring our own originality to the Torah. In fact, Ad Kedei Kach, now I'm not saying to follow this, but there are eminent Mefarshim. I mean, including Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, and then later the Tosfos Yom Tov and the like, who actually say, the Rashbam, that we have permission to explain verses even keneged Chazal, as long as it does not affect the halacha. Now, I'm not saying one should do that. I mean, what Rashi can do has nothing to do with what we can do. I mean, Rashi is a totally different level. But they actually said there was no religious objection to exploring what is called pshuto shel mikra, the simple sense of a verse, even if Chazal had a different interpretation, as long as your interpretation is not trying to change any halacha. In halacha, we must, of course, accept Chazal totally, but in Parshanut, it is said that there was a certain freedom. Now, I want to point out, this is a little controversial. The Maral, for example, totally rejected that gisha. The Maral says in many, many places that it's apikorsis, it is heresy to explain verses keneged Chazal. So that is the Maral's position. And yet, one cannot doubt that many, many, many of the Mefarshim of the Middle Ages did not have a problem as long as it was not nogeya v'halacha l'maisa. So I'm not here to be machria, I'm not here to decide this issue, I'm just here to report it and show you different ways of doing it. But l'chulei alma, if your interpretations are not keneged Chazal, the fact that you don't have a source for it does not render them illegitimate, if a character, Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us to bring our creativity to his Torah. Yeah?
But for that man to humiliate his brother and put him into Chayrim sounds so against everything you believe.
Yes.
It is a difficult story.
No, but you have to understand the situation here. This was not a private feud. If it would have been a private feud, Gamliel undoubtedly would have just forgotten about it. We are dealing with the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt. There's the Chorban Beis Hamikdash. The Jewish people are basically devastated. The Sanhedrin is the only institution that provides leadership and the like. Rabban Gamliel, as the head of the Sanhedrin, has to preserve unity. If people are going to start with their own psak halachas, if they're not going to accept, Rabbi Elazar is very great, but if he can reject the decision of the majority, what's going to happen if some Joe Blow is going to do the same thing? And then you have a disintegration of the Achdus of Am Yisrael. So he took a decision that was very, very harsh, because he felt it was absolutely necessary to preserve Jewish unity. Now, it's not for me to judge whether he was right or wrong, but I think we can fairly say that his intention was that he did something that was very, very painful, because that was the only way he could preserve unity in Am Yisrael. And those are very difficult choices sometimes, in which you're essentially sacrificing one very great person for what you perceive to be the greater interest of the Jewish nation. Let me also point out, let me point out that in a sense, Rabbi Eliezer had the keys, you know, to his own prison cell, because all Rabbi Eliezer had to do was to state he will no longer disagree with the decision, and then everything would have been over. Meaning, it was his decision not to give in, and that created the impasse. I mean, theoretically, he could have kept quiet, right? That's the whole issue of censorship, right? That's a recurring issue that we face throughout Jewish history. Do you muzzle yourself because it is for the greater good of the community? I mean, listen, Rabbi Eliezer could have thought, again, I don't know, he could have said this: listen, if I keep my position, I will be muzzled from teaching Torah for the rest of my life. If I give in on this position, I will be able to teach Torah for the rest of my life. So what do you? Maybe it's better to be censored in one thing instead of being muzzled 100%. Right? Very hard questions. Like, what do you decide? But this is what's going on. So it's a much bigger issue than a personal feud. Yeah.
Maybe I wrote the story with Rabbi Eliezer that the Sanhedrin made him come on the day that he held Yom Kippur, and come with his person.
Yeah, that's Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Gamliel had fights with a lot of people. No, that's with Rabbi Eliezer. And then he did have trouble with Rabbi Yoshua earlier. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.